This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Here's a musical question for you. Who sang the hit song Eleanor Rigby? Pop music fans will know right away, that was a trick question.
Up the rice in the church where a wedding is being, lives in a dream,
waits at the window, wearing a face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for?
That's Kansas with an assist from the London Symphony Orchestra, preceded by Alice Cooper, and then Joan Baez, and then the Beatles. You're hearing Aretha Franklin under me. The Handsome Family also sang Eleanor Rigby, and even Mr. Excitement himself, Jackie Wilson. Eleanor Rigby came out in 1966, and since then it's become one of the most widely covered songs in the world. Why is that? Other than the song just being a great song, what makes an artist want to do a cover? And what makes us want to hear one? Joining us from NPR in New York is Ray Padgett, the author of the book Cover Me. He's also the man behind the blog Cover Me, which celebrated its 10th anniversary last year. Ray, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also at NPR is Amanda Petrusich, a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her books include Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Very glad to be here.
Let me start with you, Amanda. What do you think it is about covers that entrances people, that attracts music lovers?
You know, I think it's there's something to do with the familiarity of a song, but there's a twist on it. So it's something that, you know, you recognize, maybe you know the melody, you know the beat, you know the chorus, but here it is sort of being presented in a different way. So it's, you know, a way of making the familiar strange that I think can be very intriguing for listeners.
Ray, what about you? What do you think it is about covers that hooks people?
Well, I agree with what Amanda said. I think it's that taking something that people already know and twisting it, or in some cases, taking a song that for whatever reason no one knows, the first version wasn't a hit, or it sounded different, and, you know, giving a song a second life that deserves it.
I wonder, has it always been that way, though? I mean, how have our feelings on covers, Ray, changed over time? Were music audiences always open to them?
It's evolved a lot. So, you know, before sort of the advent of rock and roll, the cover song was in some sense the default. You know, very few singers were writing their own songs. You know, Frank Sinatra wasn't writing his own songs. And then when people like Bob Dylan and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones switched from covering other people to writing their own songs, a premium became placed on the singer-songwriter, and covers kind of became a little bit of a dirty word. You know, you would hear people, you know, ragging on some musician by saying, well, I heard they don't even write their own songs. But in recent years, the pendulum has swung back, I think, in the era of the internet, where pretty much any cool band you can name, even ones who are writing great songs themselves, are putting out covers on YouTube and Spotify and it's beyond.
Yeah, Ray, I guess it is worth reminding people that what we now call covers, I guess, used to just be called standards, the American songbook.
That's exactly right. You know, I say I start the book with Elvis and with the dawn of rock and roll, and it's not because covers, you know, were invented then, just the opposite. It's when covers became a unique category as opposed to just music.
Some of you have thoughts about what makes a good cover song. David in Plainfield, Indiana writes that it's something close enough to be recognized as the original song until you go, wait, that's not the original artist. Also, if the remake is good enough to convey the original intent and feel of the song. Two covers that I love, David writes, two covers that I love are Alien Ant Farm's cover of Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal, and my favorite is Disturbed's cover of Simon and Garfunkel's The Sounds of Silence. Truly an awesome cover, and even more depth to the chilling feel of the song. In the signs and the words on the prophets are written on the subway walls, in tenement halls, in whispers.
Silence.
I wonder, Amanda, what is that kind of what makes a great cover, something that puts more depth to a song, that adds a new dimension?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the best covers can be considered, superior to the originals, which may sound like hearsay or may sound like a kind of psychotic thing to posit. But some of my favorite covers, I mean, one that comes to mind is Sinead O'Connor's cover of Nothing Compares to You, which, you know, Prince originally recorded in 1985 after he'd formed a funk band called The Family. It's included on The Family's debut LP. It wasn't released as a single. It didn't get very much attention until 5 years later when Sinead covered it. And I think her rendition of the song is the superior one for me as a listener. I think she adds a certain sort of depth, a certain melancholy to it that, you know, as much as I love Prince and you know, he's a king in my canon for sure, I think she brings something to that composition that's really unique, that's sort of distinctly kind of feminine and full of a certain amount of longing and yearning that, you know, for me makes it the superior version of that song.
Yeah, Amanda, since you brought that up, let's hear both Prince and Sinead O'Connor and compare their renditions of Nothing Compares to You. Those were Sinead O'Connor and Prince, both performing Nothing Compares to You. We are speaking to Ray Padgett, the author of the book Cover Me, and Amanda Petrosich of The New Yorker and the author of Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. Ray, is there one cover that you could point to and say, that one, that is the canonical cover song that's not only a great one, but a model for what cover songs should be, should do, should accomplish?
Sure. I'd probably point to the one that actually started me down my obsession with covers in the first place over a decade ago, which is the soul singer Billy Stewart's cover of the George Gershwin song Summertime. So hush. The reason it's sort of the ideal cover for me is that it takes a song, Summertime, that everyone knows, everyone's heard a million times, often done the same way, slow, languid, sort of like a torch song, and totally revamps it. His is fast, there's drum solos, scatting, he's yelling and yelping. And so that's the beauty of a cover. You can take even the most sort of cliched and often sung song and do something totally different with it. Do not let a tear fall from your eye. Oh! Drew emailed, my favorite cover of all time is the cover of Don't Think Twice by Mike Ness. The Bob Dylan original is sad and plaintive, but Ness's version is harder, almost angry. Considering the topic is the end of a relationship, Ness captured my feelings about that situation much better than the original. Andy in Jacksonville, Florida writes, most cover songs are a waste of time and effort, in my opinion. The only cover I can think of that actually improved the original was Janis Joplin's cover of Kris Kristofferson's Me and Bobby McGee. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. And feeling good was easy now when he sang the blues. You know, good enough for me, good enough for me and my Bobby McGee. And Catherine asks, why is it called a cover and not just a remake or whatever, right? It comes from actually the 1940s, when the cover song was sort of the opposite of what we're talking about, great covers that change the songs. What labels would do is when there was a hit song on the radio, they would scramble to record a version that sounded identical to it and try to get it into stores so their version would literally cover up the famous version on the shelves and confuse purchasers.
So it was a business decision. It wasn't an artistic decision.
Yeah, exactly. These were covers that were deliberately identical. Woolworth, the major department store chain, actually had an in-house label whose sole purpose was essentially ripping off hit songs and trying to sell them to their customers so they made more money on their own label.
This must have gotten litigious at a certain point. I mean, artists don't like to have their songs ripped off. Although, you know, in the early days of the music industry, things like music rights and music licensing and who owned the sheet music, that was an emerging business. I wonder how long it took for artists and composers and producers and labels to get hip to all of that.
Yeah, it was sort of a gray area and, you know, confusing for a lot of people, especially, you know, in the dawn of recorded music. Where it ended up, you know, by the early days of rock and roll is you can cover any song you want. You don't need anyone's permission. You don't need the Beatles to say, okay, you can cover Eleanor Rigby. All you have to do is buy a license that essentially pays, you know, the Beatles a little bit of money every time your song is sold.
This is one of those topics that we got hundreds of comments on. Every so often, we pick one that everyone wants to talk about, and this is one. We got lots and lots and lots and lots of voicemails recommending some cover songs that you felt we should discuss. But one song, and I wonder if some of you know what it is, one song came up again and again and again.
Best cover song of all time is All Along the Watchtower.
All Along the Watchtower.
All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix.
There must be some kind of way out of here.
It's written by Bob Dylan, the greatest songwriter of the 20th century, and it's performed by Jimi Hendrix, the greatest guitar player of the 20th century.
I love it because it captures the spirit of the song with great energy.
The way that his guitar playing and the mood that he sets so perfectly fits the words.
Hendrix covering Dylan. What else can you say?
We loved your recommendations so much we made a playlist. You'll find that online at the1a.org. There are more than 400 songs on the list. Like I said, we got a gigantic response. So listen to it on Shuffle, enjoy, and let us know what you think should be on the list if we needed a 401st song. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Amanda Petrusich, I can imagine that an artist of the caliber of a Bob Dylan would be terrifying for a musician to try to cover. Do you think there are certain artists who no one should really touch? Maggie tweeted, in my non-professional opinion, no one can cover Michael Jackson's Billie Jean. It's too iconic. Are there certain songs or artists that are just untouchable?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, I agree with her. Michael Jackson is really tough. I think to, you know, beat his performance and the kind of particular sort of idiosyncratic, you know, way of singing and inhabiting those songs would be really, really difficult. I mean, I mentioned a Prince cover earlier, but I think Prince in general is a tough guy to cover for very similar reasons. You know, Dylan being, as you know, many listeners pointed out, being such a terrific and such a sort of rightfully lauded songwriter, I think it's intimidating to take on a Dylan song. But I think we see his songs covered with quite a bit of success over the years. And sometimes, you know, the covers, I mean, I'm thinking of the Byrds cover of Mr. Tambourine Man from 1965. Sometimes we see covers of his songs, you know, end up being more commercially successful than his recordings of them.
Yeah, I think one example of that kind of commercial success, Sawita writes on our Facebook page about one of my absolute favorites. Sawita writes, Luther Vandross's cover of A House Is Not a Home is my absolute fave. The original, released by Dionne Warwick in 1964, is truly a sweet love song, but the slowed-down musical arrangement and entrancing vocal delivery by Luther in his 1981 remake takes the song from something simply sweet to something that is incredibly heartfelt and unforgettable.
And a house is not a home when there's no one there to hold you tight, and no one there you can kiss goodnight.
Amanda, that seems to be an aspect of some of these covers that were mentioned, including, I think, Disturbed's cover of The Sound of Silence, that makes them kind of pop, that there's something emotional under them that the original doesn't plumb as deeply as the cover does.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Johnny Cash's cover of Nine Inch Nails' Hurt is another example of that, where I think, you know, Cash kind of imbued that song with this sort of deep existential dread that is present a little bit in the original, but maybe not quite to the same degree.
And you could have it all. My empire of dirt. I will let you down. I will make you hurt.
So there is, you know, what Ray was talking about earlier, that idea of you know, flipping the song a little bit and maybe taking the opposite approach from the original can be, you know, in some ways I think it lays the sort of skeleton of the song bare. I mean, you get to really kind of appreciate the songwriting and you know, in all of the ways in which it can be interpreted and reinterpreted.
I think also the cover of Careless Whisper by the rock band Saliva. In some ways, I like it better than George Michael's original. I know that is heretical. I have just sinned against the patron saint of pop music, but it kind of did that. It's a dirge, and it's heartbreaking in ways that, like, the original, which is kind of lilting and a pop song, doesn't really do. But Ray Padgett, what do you think? Are there certain songs or artists that are just kind of too hot to touch for a cover song?
Short answer is no. I believe any song is coverable. The catch is goes at something Amanda was saying, where someone like Michael Jackson or Prince not only wrote brilliant songs, but they performed and recorded them brilliantly. Whereas I think that's a little different than someone like Bob Dylan, who, you know, I love his recordings, but over the years they've been proven to be not exactly mass appeal. You know, Bob Dylan has had a number of number one songs, but none that he recorded himself. They're all the Birds and the Turtles and Peter, Paul and Mary and people like that. So I think if you're going to cover, you know, someone like Bob Dylan, you can sort of make it your own relatively easily by just not sounding like Bob Dylan. If you're going to cover Michael Jackson, you really have to work your way in there and somehow do something different, because you're not going to do Michael Jackson better than Michael Jackson did.
Janiqua writes, I recently heard an amazing cover of Unforgettable by Nat King Cole performed by Sia. I believe Cole's is perfect, and I was convinced no one should have the audacity to remake it except for maybe Natalie Cole. But the Sia version is unique and beautiful. It's a lovely homage to the Coles. A terribly hideous example of a cover is the Michael Bublé version of Feeling Good, originally performed by Nina Simone. The Bublé version lacks the depth, soul, and intensity of the Simone version. He should not have even tried. Amanda, what about that? I love Michael Bublé, but if he ain't the whitest singer that ever walked the face of the earth. I mean, hearing him try to cover Me and Mrs. Jones, it's We Got a Thing Going On, not We've Got a Thing Going On. I mean, he's the whitest singer I ever heard. There's something right. That just gets lost when certain people step out of their lane.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and Nina Simone is another tough one that should be on one of those, you know, tread very, very carefully lists, because she's obviously bringing, you know, so much sort of depth and you know, her particular experience of the world to those songs. And you know, to assume that you could do the same is, you know, would require some extraordinary hubris for sure. But, you know, I think we've seen in recent years, there's been a kind of trend on YouTube and online of, you know, young white artists sort of taking hip-hop songs or pop songs that were produced or performed by black artists and sort of reimagining them as folk songs. We've seen this, and it's such a complicated question of kind of what's allowed, what's appropriation, what's homage. I mean, in some ways, those feel like the kind of central cultural questions of our day. And it is really tricky, and I think figuring, there is a, you know, degree of respect that needs to be paid when performing a cover song. And you know, maybe that's something Bublé sort of fumbled with that particular song.
I think that's something we should get to. And by the way, for those of you who are listening who are Michael Bublé fans, do not come at me for criticizing Michael Bublé or for my impression. I don't want to hear it. But I do take your point about that. And maybe that bears a little unpacking. Macy tweeted, can you talk about the history of white musicians covering or appropriating the music of black artists? A recent example is a white man on YouTube covering Beyoncé's pro-black album Formation. We also got a voicemail from one of our listeners who is rather less enthused about this idea of cover songs. Here is what she left in our inbox.
Hi, this is Marie from Louisville, Kentucky. I have to be honest, I'm surprised that you're using that term. If I'm not mistaken, the history of the term cover song and cover artist referred to the times of segregation, when white artists would do their own version of a black song in order to get an audience for the song, because the white people didn't want to contribute to the popularity of black artists.
Ray Padgett, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that. But before we do, I wonder if we could play a clip of a hit song that I think most people heard from the latter of these two artists and may never have heard of the original inspiration.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog when snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog when snooping around my door.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl.
That was Elvis Presley singing Hound Dog, led by Big Mama Thornton, who was the original artist behind that. Ray Padgett, talk about that, about the racial component of cover songs.
Well, the listener's absolutely right. There's sort of a dark side to the history of covers, and you know that's why I talk about it in the book, and that's why Elvis is the first chapter. You know, the charts back in, particularly in the early half of the 20th century, were totally segregated. There was the R&B chart, which had literally been called the race chart shortly before Elvis, and then the pop chart, which basically translated to the white chart. And so you'd have people having genuine hits on the R&B chart, including Big Mama Thornton singing Hound Dog. People think it was some super obscure. It actually did pretty well in the African-American community, but was not at all being heard by white audiences. So someone like Elvis then comes along and changes it. I mean, Pat Boone practically made a cottage industry out of covering hits by Little Richard and people like that that, you know, white audiences weren't being exposed to until Pat Boone does them.
It wasn't one of Pat Boone's big hits. I remember seeing a clip of him on, like, Lawrence Welk or the Ed Sullivan Show or something, him singing a very sanitized version of Tutti Frutti.
Both sanitized, but also sort of just trying to copy it as closely as possible. I mean, at least Elvis's Hound Dog sounds pretty different than Big Mama Thornton's. But with many artists, like Pat Boone, the goal was to sound as similar as possible, but to have put a white face on it.
Well, and maybe it's part. Maybe that's part of it, Ray. I mean, as I remember hearing Pat Boone's version of Tutti Frutti, it was very, like, sanitized and very mass market. At least with Elvis, he seemed to have some of the stylistic, the rhythm and the licks and the kind of the rockabilly feel. He was at least in the ballpark.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's why I focus on that, because I wanted to talk about the history, but also, you know, not write about a song that isn't bringing anything creatively to the table. Elvis, he's got the rockabilly. He translates the sound. And the interesting thing about that song is that he translates the lyrics, too. The original lyrics that Big Mama Thornton sang were very much a relationship song about, you know, a no good man. And the lyrics Elvis is singing are literally about a dog, you know, about chasing rabbits. And there was a funny quote from the original songwriters. They hated the Elvis version. They said, this makes no sense. But then in later years, they would append to that, we hated the Elvis version until the checks started coming in.
Kevin wrote on our Facebook page, is the greatness of a cover defined by whether most people even know another artist released it before them? If so, Aretha Franklin's cover of Respect and Otis Redding's song should rank quite high.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take out T-C-T.
Jason also tweeted, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Aretha Franklin's defining anthem made Otis Redding's version ludicrously misogynistic.
What you want, honey, you got it. And what you need, baby, you got it. All I'm asking for a little respect when I come home.
Amanda, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think that what Aretha does to that song, I mean, and for me, that would be in my kind of pantheon of the greatest covers of all time. It does completely change and sort of redirect and reimagine the essential message of that song. And I think makes it, you know, an empowerment anthem, as it has been for decades, versus a kind of sort of odious, a little bit uncomfortable song about something else entirely. So I think it's a great example of you know, a really singular and powerful artist kind of reimagining that skeleton of a song and, you know, turning it into something I think really beautiful and really moving.
And for people who haven't heard the original, Amanda, when you talk about kind of the feel of the Otis Redding song, can you elaborate on that a little more?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the original version of Respect, I think when it's not being sung by a woman, it's missing that sort of inherent kind of seed of, you know, Aretha's correcting for a power imbalance that, you know, exists culturally and exists in society, and she's, you know, responding to it in a way that I think is really transformative. When a man sings that song, you know, and not to even necessarily single out Otis Redding in particular, but I think when any man sings that song, it becomes about reinforcing that power imbalance rather than subverting it.
I wonder, since we got to Aretha Franklin's Respect, that's Aretha Franklin's song now. And there are a number of examples of covers that have really kind of become the new canonical version of that song. Fatima writes on our Facebook page, "My favorite cover is Whitney Houston's version of I Will Always Love You by Dolly Parton. Truthfully, I see the song as a total remake. I don't think it can ever be covered again." And then there's also this song, which in some ways has become so canonical and recorded by so many artists, it's gotten a little far away for some from the original.
Hallelujah, hallelujah.
That was Jeff Buckley performing Hallelujah, originally by Leonard Cohen. Jason asked on our Facebook page, what are the legalities for covering songs? Ray?
So it's actually relatively clear-cut. Essentially, if you cover a song as an artist and you keep the lyrics intact, you can do it. All you have to do is buy what's called a mechanical license, which basically means the original songwriter gets a cut. But you don't need anyone's permission. Where it gets a little fuzzier is if you want to change any of the lyrics. There's a story in my book about the Fugees doing Killing Me Softly, you know, which became a huge hit. And when they first recorded it, they wanted to change the title and the chorus to Killing the Sound Boy, which was sort of a, you know, Jamaican slang for, like, killing the poser. They thought it made it sound more hip-hop. It made it seem like it would fit into their thing more. But they had to get permission from the songwriters, who said, no, you can cover the song, but you have to leave the lyrics intact. And I talked to Praz, and he said that was the best thing that could have happened to them because it made it universal. It made it not something that non-hip-hop listeners wouldn't understand.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly.
That was Killing Me Softly. You just heard the original artist, Roberta Flack, followed by the remake by the Fugees. Ray, how do musicians feel about having their songs covered? Is it kind of like Hound Dog, where as long as the check doesn't bounce, it's fine?
Generally, yes. People are like it for two reasons. One is financial. If someone covers a song you wrote, you make money. So there's that sort of that pure version there. But also creative. I think most musicians, you know, they like to think that they have written a song that is so universal that other people can find their way into it. But there are exceptions. And one, ironically, since we've talked about him already, is Prince. Prince was always ragging on covers of that people did of him. He said they shouldn't be allowed to, which, again, is funny because, like, the song Nothing Compares to You, one of his best-known songs, no one would know if not for a cover.
Amanda, I wonder what your take is on this. When a song ends up being lessened by a cover, is there a threshold there?
Yeah, I mean, I think Hallelujah is kind of the perfect example of that. I mean, Jeff Buckley's cover of that song, which I think in many ways is the best-known cover, is really based on John Cale's arrangement. John Cale of the Velvet Underground covered right. That song as well. And I think we've seen it overused to the point of, you know, nonsense almost. It has kind of soundtracked so many sort of teary, you know, climaxes of television dramas that you know, it's lost some of its potency, which is a drag. So I think, you know, you can reach market saturation with a cover, with a song, where it starts to lose all meaning.
And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of
I do want to readdress the aspect of race and cover songs. A number of you have written about that, and I feel like we need to hit that one more time. Richard emailed, "So black artists cover white singers, but white artists appropriate black songs?" Paul Simon was accused by some students in a Howard University forum of appropriating the African music of Ladysmith Black Mambazo for Graceland. Seems to me he just made them very, very wealthy. Also, getting a number of comments about my thoughts on Michael Bublé, John tweeted, "Is color a reason someone can't cover a song?" And Jason tweeted, "While I understand the criticism of Bublé, calling him the whitest singer ever only perpetuates stereotypes that continue to divide us all." Fair criticism. I will cop to that. Ray Padgett, what about that? I wonder where that line is. Is it just the kind of thing where if I'm a black artist, appropriation applies to me, but say if I am a white artist performing from a specific cultural background or a specific musical tradition, the appropriation standard moves? How do we draw the line between a cover and appropriation?
It's a tricky line to draw because, you know, in principle, I am for anyone covering anything. I don't think there should be barriers. White artists should be able to cover African-American artists and vice versa. You know, but it's true that sort of culture can receive things differently. To go back to the Elvis example we were talking about, there's no real indication that Elvis himself had any ill will towards Big Mama Thornton. But, you know, it's received in a culture where his becomes a much bigger hit. And, you know, I think artists need to be conscientious of that. A lot of things have improved since then, obviously. But, you know, for instance, a modern version of that is you will have tons of white artists on YouTube and elsewhere covering, you know, hip-hop songs. And again, I'm for that. That's fine. But if it's something that's really personal to the original artist, really personal to the black community, you know, I think you need to have, to quote Aretha Franklin, a certain amount of respect.
Yeah, Amanda, I did want to get to that. I'm glad you mentioned YouTube, Ray, because last year there was kind of this social media uproar over some acoustic covers of black artists on YouTube. There were some white artists who covered a hit by Rihanna. Here's one of those covers.
Work, 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 work. She said I gotta work, 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 work. She see me do my dirt, 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 dirt. So I put in work, work.
Now that, of course, sounds nothing like the original, and some black artists really did not approve of that, so they came up with the hashtag trap covers and covered, for example, Taylor Swift.
You belong with me, yeah, you belong with me. He wish you would see that you belong with me, cause he were Skechers.
Amanda, where is the line between covering and appropriating a song?
Sure. I mean, it's a complicated question. For me, things get problematic or things get uncomfortable when you feel like the artist that's covering the song is, you know, decontextualizing or misunderstanding something essential about the song. I mean, we mentioned Nina Simone before. I think, you know, or a singer like Billie Holiday, if you were to cover Strange Fruit, for example, you know, and do it in a sort of goofy, kind of happy-go-lucky way, I think you would be totally, you know, misunderstanding the kind of essential root of that song.
And you would get tarred and feathered for doing it because that song is about black men being lynched in the Jim Crow South.
Exactly. So I think any cover that kind of fails, you know, willfully fails to sort of misunderstand, you know, the meaning of the song, it becomes a bit uncomfortable, and particularly when there's a, you know, a racial component to it. I mean, I think those trap covers are kind of fun and funny and for me felt like a really sort of appropriate and kind of great response. I mean, you know, trap being a subgenre of EDM and hip-hop that's kind of unsentimental and aggressive, and the beat is really hard and sharp. You know, the percussion tends to originate from an 808 drum machine. I mean, we associate it with, you know, Waka Flocka Flame, Gucci Mane, Young Jeezy, these really kind of tough, tough, tough rappers. So then to take a Taylor Swift song, which is, you know, as poppy as it can be, and kind of reinterpret in that way, I mean, for me, that felt fun. It felt like a sort of mark of, you know, ingenuity in a way. I didn't find it, you know, offensive. But again, it's you know, which way that sort of highway goes is very complicated.
We have to take a quick break, but when we're back, we'll add another voice to the conversation. Scott Bradley created a music collective that produces covers of pop songs in different styles. As we go out, you're hearing a vintage cover of Radiohead's hit song Creep by Postmodern Jukebox, Scott Bradley's group, featuring Haley Reinhart.
What the hell am I doing? Support for NPR and the following message come from U.S. Army Medicine, one of the nation's innovative medical institutions that puts healthcare professionals at the forefront of medicine. U.S. Army Medicine is an elite team pioneering new medical discoveries to make a difference in the lives of Americans. Army Medicine is your chance to push medicine further. Learn more at goarmy.com/amed. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Discover Card. You check your email or social media all the time, but Discover asks, what about checking something as important as your credit score? Well, Discover makes it quick and easy with their credit scorecard, which is free for everyone, even if you're not a customer. See your FICO credit score and other important credit information. And once you know your score, you should check to see if your current credit card is the best fit for you. Learn more at discover.com/credit scorecard. Limitations apply.
Pianist Scott Bradley has been a jazz musician and composer since he was 12 years old. 5 years ago, he started a music collective called Postmodern Jukebox. It produces covers of pop songs in alternate styles like ragtime, jazz, and swing.
Because you know I'm all about that bass and no trouble. I'm all about that bass and no trouble. I'm all about that bass and no trouble. I'm all about that bass.
Yeah, it's pretty clear I ain't no size two, but I can shake it like I'm supposed to. 'Cause I got that boom boom that all the boys are chasing, all the right junk in all the right places.
Postmodern Jukebox kicks off another tour this week. Scott has a book coming out called Outside the Jukebox, How I Turned My Vintage Music Obsession into a Dream Gig. Scott, welcome to 1A.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm okay. I'm not sure how I feel about you swinging all about that bass. I wonder what you... I'm not against it. I'm not against it. But, you know, I'm wondering what about the music of Meghan Trainor made you think, yeah, swing. That makes sense.
So in this case, it was really a literal thing. You know, the title is all about that bass. And what we do with Postmodern Jukebox is we take modern-day songs and kind of put them in different historical contexts, you know. So as if you're hearing like a Justin Bieber song, how it would sound in the doo-wop era or something like that. So in this case, we took All About That Bass and made it literally about an upright bass. And in that version, yeah, Casey Abrams was a singer, and he's actually playing an upright bass while he's doing it. So that was a pretty literal one right there.
And I want to make sure that we don't think you're just being cheeky. Like, you're not just doing these as parodies or as satires. This is like a real musical pursuit. You're not just trying to kind of make fun.
No, I think a lot of people, you know, if they see a video for the first time, they might think that. They might think that it's just like a parody or some kind of thing. But, you know, I'm taking it seriously. You know, and the first time that we did that, I took a Nickelback song. I took How You Remind Me, and I made it into like a Motown song. And, you know, I think that initially everybody was like, oh, I get the gimmick. You know, you're taking Nickelback, this band, whatever, you know, and putting it in a different genre. But I try to take it seriously. I try to just pull apart a song and find DNA, what makes it, you know, a unique song. And then really kind of, you know, do it as accurately and with as much respect to the original as possible.
How did you form Postmodern Jukebox?
So I was a struggling jazz pianist, which I think is, you know, familiar to a lot of people. I moved to New York and I had these big dreams. I was like, I'm going to be a jazz pianist. I'm going to take over the city. And none of that happened. And I couldn't even get a gig. So I turned to YouTube and I started just making, you know, I put out like a medley of myself playing ragtime piano, but I was playing 80s songs. I was playing like Careless Whisper and Take On Me and stuff like that. And it went viral. So I was like, okay, this is cool. I mean, I've never had anybody listen to me play before. So I realized that there was this kind of awesome audience on the internet that was into this kind of, you know, idea of reworking genres. And so I decided to kind of, you know, call my friends over. I'm like, hey, we're going to take this Lady Gaga song and we're going to play it as 1920s. And they were like, what? Okay, whatever, you know, and gradually it kind of just went from there and it became this just awesome community where we've been able to pull all these incredible artists that I'm honored to work with all the time, and they've all become a part of it. So it's pretty cool.
Let's play another clip from one of your songs. This one's from 2015, featuring singer Robin Adele Anderson, which is a take on a song that is a cover of a cover.
Oh, I'm the kind of G the little homies wanna be, like on my knees in the night saying prayers in the street light. Been spending most their lives living in the gangster's paradise.
That was Postmodern Jukebox doing a cover of Coolio's hit Gangster's Paradise, followed by Coolio's 1995 version. That song actually samples from Stevie Wonder's Pastime Paradise from the seminal double album set Songs in the Key of Life. I have to say, Scott, I kind of buy that cover because the whole gangster thing, it could be like a 1920s hoodlum kind of thing. But on the flip side, we just had this conversation about race and covers and culture and covers. And I wonder how you navigate that.
So, you know, my whole thing is about keeping things authentic and not doing stuff just for, you know, just for a laugh or, you know, or making fun of any kind of thing. You know, I think that it was really important to me, and especially as somebody that is a fan of, I mean, I used to love that song when I was a kid. And
which
and
one, Gangster's Paradise original, or Pastime Paradise?
Gangster's Paradise. And then, well, you know, it kind of takes the hook from Pastime Paradise. It's not a straight cover.
It's not a straight cover.
So
right.
They just take the, it, you know, which is common in hip hop. So what I wanted to do is kind of put it in a setting that was interesting, that kind of added another element to it to kind of bring out certain details in it. And that was by taking it into this like 1920s Chicago hot jazz, you know, the kind of music that you would hear at a speakeasy. And that's the music that I love. I grew up playing that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think it's all about the intentions. I think that there are some people that like, you know, the example of taking a Rihanna song or whatever and doing it just to get views or just to get, you know, like, oh, look at me, I'm being cool, I'm being so edgy or something like that. You know, I don't really do that kind of stuff.
I wonder, Ray, if I could come back to you for a question from Jim. Jim writes, what are the best comical covers? How about Robin Williams doing Elmer Fudd singing Springsteen's Fire, or David Sedaris doing Billie Holiday's Away in a Manger from his Santaland Diaries about being an elf at Macy's? And Denise writes, where does Weird Al fall in this conversation? Can't help but think about Amish Paradise. What about comedic parodies and covers, Ray?
So I say that the parody, I always call it the cousin of the cover, in the sense that in a cover, you're keeping the lyrics and changing the music. In a parody, you're keeping the music and changing the lyrics. And so Weird Al, I actually wrote about him in the book and I interviewed him because he's sort of an interesting example of that's a different way you can flip a song. But there have been just straight comedy covers, too, to answer the first question. William Shatner is someone who's been sort of doing them for years and he often gets made fun of. But, you know, I think a lot of them are tongue in cheek when he's doing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds or Rocket Man or something. You know, there's a bit of a wink there. Another one I write about in the book, which sort of presages the YouTube cross-genre covers that Scott's been talking about, is the Gourds covering Snoop Dogg's Gin and Juice, which was the first song to go viral in a bluegrass sense. Mm-hmm. So I think definitely you can either do a parody, which is literally changing the words to throw in jokes, or by changing the genre, you can do a comedy cover. But as Scott said, novelty will only take you so far. You have to have something else if you want people to listen more than once.
I have to say there's one cover that did not come out in a lot of the comments from our listeners. And I'm kind of shocked that no one brought this up because I believe that it is the most famous cover song ever.
Start spreading the news, I'm leaving today. I wanna be a part of it. New York, New York.
These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York.
Frank Sinatra, as chairman of the board, of course, got a lot of credit for New York, New York, but it was originally written for Liza Minnelli in the movie New York, New York in 1977. Ray Padgett, this seems like the ultimate case of a cover where another artist, granted, nothing against Sinatra, but completely made that song his and just owned that song. I don't think most people who hear it know it's a cover.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I'd hedge to guess that's why people didn't mention it that much. A lot of what we've been talking about has been covers of songs people already know, but the flip side of that is something like that, where people don't even realize the song is a cover. I mean, like Marvin Gaye doing Heard It Through the Grapevine. People hear that, they don't know it's a cover. And so, you know, Frank Sinatra, I think, is interesting because he's, yeah, I realize that song, you know, came out later in his career, but he's sort of a holdover from the era where the cover was just the thing he did. Like I said, he wasn't writing his own songs. So, you know, he makes the song his own, and because the original wasn't a big hit, sort of eclipses it in the popular imagination.
Liz tweeted, "We played postmodern jukebox songs at our wedding, as well as a lot of the Vitamin String Quartet's Geek Wedding covers." Aaron says that Scott is his favorite cover artist of all time. Clearly, Scott, you've got some fans, and before we're out of time, I wonder who you find gravitates to your music. What kind of fans do you attract?
Yeah, it's a pretty diverse crowd. It's pretty much all ages, like, because, you know, we get some older people that are into it because it's the styles that they grew up with. But, you know, I'm kind of an old soul in that way. I kind of like all that old stuff. And then we get the younger crowd that knows the pop songs, and they're like, you know, I want to hear this Bruno Mars song, but done as swing or whatever, you know? So we get a kind of a wide cross section. I mean, there's been times where you look out, I look out in the front row and I'll see like a 16-year-old kid and then like their grandma both, you know, singing All About That Bass or something. And it's kind of a weird sensation to see that.
I wonder if we could work our way around your favorite cover song or the cover song that you wish had never been recorded. Ray Padgett, a favorite or one you wish that had never been made?
Well, I'll go with a favorite to be positive, and I'll say Devo covering Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. That's one where everyone knows the original, yet they were irreverent enough to essentially throw out everything but the lyrics and come up with a totally different arrangement.
And Amanda, favorite, or one you wish had never been made?
Oh, man, I will second Ray's choice for that Devo cover, which is terrific, and then I will match it with Britney Spears' cover of Satisfaction, which Ray and I were discussing earlier, which I think kind of fails to get the job done.
That's Amanda Petrusich, staff writer for The New Yorker. She's the author of several books, including Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. Amanda, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
Ray Padgett, author of the book Cover Me and the man behind the blog Cover Me. Ray, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Scott Bradley, founder of the music collective Postmodern Jukebox. His upcoming book is called Outside the Jukebox, How I Turned My Vintage Music Obsession into a Dream Gig. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this episode involved a ton of your participation. Thank you so much for helping make this episode so much fun. We always want to hear your comments or your questions or your favorite cover songs to include in the 1A podcast. Follow us on Twitter. We're at 1A. Or follow us on Facebook and stay up to date on the shows that we're planning each week. You can always leave comments or suggestions, and those might make it on the show. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.